Well, first of all, they're of course concerned. Putin has built up more forces on the border than he ever has before. So although he has invaded Ukraine in the past, and he has occupied portions and still does, this is unprecedented.
Explain unprecedented.
We're looking at over 100,000 troops and the support facilities to enable a serious invasion. Not just a small occupation or an incursion, which is what many people expect, but a full-scale invasion. And my concern is that we're not well enough prepared for that potential outcome. Now, look, Putin has all the options on the table right now. He can do whatever he wants. He can continue the political pressure, the internal strife that he's sowing. He can ratchet it up by making a small incursion into part of the country, or he could do a full-scale blitzkrieg style invasion. And it's that third option that I'm most concerned about.
So why is this happening, and why do you want your constituents here in the Commonwealth, the rest of the people of the Commonwealth, to know, understand, and care?
It's a great question because look, I'm excited to be home for Christmas. Everybody's excited to be home for the holidays. Why should we care what's going on halfway around the globe? Well, the reason is that we have an alliance in Europe called NATO that's kept the peace for 75 years, kept the peace since World War II through a brutal Cold War and through lots of uncertainty and unrest afterwards. And the credibility of that alliance is now being called into question by Vladimir Putin. Ukraine's not technically part of NATO, but they've made it very clear they want to be part of NATO. And our NATO allies and ourselves, we have made it very clear that we want to keep Ukraine independent. Putin's threatening to stop that. And if he ends independence in Ukraine by taking over the country, then everyone's going to wonder which country is next. And that could affect American lives. It will absolutely affect our economy.
How? But really spell it out for us, please. How does it affect American lives, our economy, et cetera?
So the president has made it clear that we're not going to put American troops into Ukraine to fight the Russians. But we have security guarantees with the actual members of NATO, the full-fledged members, not just a nation like Ukraine that's looking to become a NATO member, but all the Eastern European allies. We've said if Russia threatens you, we will put American troops there. American troops will fight alongside yours. If Putin decides to build off whatever victory he might attain in Ukraine and go to one of our allies next, I mean, we could be looking at a World War III type scenario. No one expects it to go there quickly, but look, we never imagined 9/11. We never imagined Putin would take over part of Ukraine in 2014.
I thought you were going to say a World War I type scenario, actually, where the dominoes all fall because of the pacts we have with other countries.
Look, that's a good analogy as well. I don't know that it would be the reason why World War II comes to mind is because, Putin is, look, he's a pretty evil guy. He believes in authoritarian regimes. He wants to conquer parts of Europe. He's made that very clear in the same way that Hitler did.
So I'm going to be completely transparent with you, Congressman. You know, this is Radio Boston. I usually do local. If we were talking about the tea, I'd have all my game with me. I don't know this region well. I don't know when you say Putin is evil, this is like Hitler. We could be looking at World War III. Are you on the far end of this? Like, is this what most
No.
people
Look, I'm
think?
not saying he's like it. I'm not saying that this is definitely going to happen like this. But what I am saying is that you give him an inch, he takes a mile. Ukraine might not affect American troops because we have troops there now, but they probably won't stay in the event of an invasion. But if he starts to go to other European allies where we have American troops, even have American bases, then all of a sudden we could see a Russia on America war. And always the risk with that kind of scenario is that it escalates. And most people will say, Seth, don't be alarmist. It's never going to get that bad. But, every time we've had a sort of foreign policy mistake in America, it's because of a failure of imagination. We never imagined that terrorists could attack us the way they did on 9/11. We never imagined that the Taliban, this ragtag force that harbored the attackers on 9/11, would make it to Kabul in a few days. We can't make the mistake of failing to imagine how bad this could get.
So I'm going to pick up on this idea of failure of imagination and bring up another heavy topic. There were many who never imagined we would see Americans breach the Capitol in a violent insurrection last January 6th. I'm grateful that you're going to join us on the anniversary this coming January 6th, and we'll talk more about that day then. For now, I want to ask you how you are viewing the work of the January 6th Commission, which has made quite a bit of news recently, including the criminal contempt vote against Mark Meadows, former Donald Trump aide, Mark Meadows. How do you feel the commission's doing? Are you satisfied?
Well, let me just start by saying, Tiziana, that I join you. I'd never imagined that either. In fact, what happened on January 6th was something that I imagined happening just about any day as a Marine in Iraq. I never imagined it happening in the United States of America. And it's easy to forget how close we came to truly losing our democracy, to having someone who had no respect for the results of the election, no respect for the voice of the American people, just throw the results out. That's the kind of corruption you expect in a place like Russia, not in the United States. That's why the work of the January 6th Commission is so important, because look, no one else is doing anything. We've tried to pass laws in Congress. They're stuck in the Senate. We have to do what we can today to prevent that from ever happening in the future.
Is there more that you would like to see this Congress or this White House do now to be protecting democracy at home? I'm struck by how often in commentary now I hear people refer to our democracy as so fragile, Congressman.
It is. It is. And it's a poor example to democracies around the world. We have got to find a way to come together. There are a few brave Republicans who are part of this commission. Liz Cheney, who's had the courage to stand up and serve on this commission, even though she supported Trump in the past, she has more security than just about anybody else in the House of Representatives today.
Being clear for our listeners, Republican from Wyoming.
Republican from Wyoming, many people had never heard of her before. Now her life is regularly threatened by fellow Republicans just because she's willing to save our democracy and go against Donald Trump to do so, of course. So ultimately, big changes only really work in Washington when they're bipartisan.
So I'm going to narrow our aperture even more. Today, the Boston Public Health Commission, in an email, notified the public 3 cases of Omicron found in Boston. Young people not fully vaccinated, according to the statement. We are still in this pandemic, and cases up, hospitalizations up, growing concern about Omicron. Build Back Better and Congress still out there, sitting out there, needs on the ground here. What does Congress need to be doing for your constituents right now, and how do we get it done, especially around financial support for people still struggling in this pandemic?
Well, Congress has provided a tremendous amount of financial support, and it's helped a lot. But clearly, the pandemic isn't over. And so we'll be looking at what we need to do in the future. There are a few things, though, that we need to do more specifically. We've got to have a long-term vaccine solution. We've got to have a vaccine that ultimately gets us out of this pandemic, not just bounces us from one variant to the next. We've got to find ways to encourage more Americans to get their shots. You know what I did an hour ago, Tiziana?
What?
I got my booster.
Congratulations.
We all have to do that. We've got to go out and get
our booster. I could hear your excitement when you said that.
I feel great. And it's important because I know that I'm doing something that doesn't just protect me, it protects my family. You know, my mom is over here helping me take care of the kids right now. Want to make sure she's safe. Want to make sure my kids are safe. It protects everyone that I work with, everyone that I run into with the grocery store tonight. So go out and get your booster. If you haven't gotten your second dose, or maybe you even haven't gotten your first yet, do it now. Don't wait. Don't let the holidays be an opportunity to spread coronavirus. Let it be an opportunity to spread joy the way it always has been, and an opportunity to show that you care about the lives of others.
One last question on this. A lot of statewide news we've been following between Governor Baker, the State House, the pandemic relief money finally signed, but still disagreement between the governor and the legislature about how much oversight to provide to payments, relief payments to individuals. Today, we have pandemic era voting laws expiring because the legislature did not extend them. So, for example, no fault mail-in voting ends after today. We had Secretary Galvin on yesterday, quite put out by that, especially given that we're still in a pandemic. Do you have a message to our legislature, to the governor, about what we need to be doing locally to support people right now?
Absolutely. Make it easier to vote, not harder. I mean, what American patriot can honestly say we should make it harder to vote in our democracy?
Last question. This one's for fun, because later this hour, we're going to be taking listener calls after the kerfuffle that erupted, I would say, in the Twitterverse after Boston Mayor Michelle Wu suggested that people ought to be talking to each other on the T. So you are a transit person. Do you talk to people on transit?
Not as much as I should. You know, I noticed that whenever you sit down next to someone on a train, like you're taking the train to New York, a longer distance train, in other words, you start talking, you get to know people much more so than people do on the plane. It's a much more relaxed atmosphere. But I don't know, there's this sort of code of silence on the commuter rail in the morning where you're not supposed to say a word. I mean, it's much quieter on a 100-person commuter rail car than it is at home in my house. I think it's a time when we need to be friendly. And I'm going to take this as a New Year's resolution. I'm going to try to talk more politely. Not too loudly, but I'm going to try to talk more on the T.
All right. So we get to talk to you again on January 6th. I will check in with you on your resolution.
You check in on how it's going after 6 days.
I will. Congressman Seth Moulton, who represents the 6th Massachusetts Congressional District, just returned from a bipartisan congressional delegation trip to Ukraine. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Tiziana.
You heard our conversation with U.S. Representative Seth Moulton. And one of the subjects we touched on was the January 6th Commission. We are almost a year out from that infamous date now. And the last time we talked with our next guest, it was to talk about prosecutions in that case. Andrew Lelling is former U.S. attorney from the Trump administration. He is now a partner at the law firm Jones Day. Andrew, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I promise lots to ask you, especially about your perspectives as the former U.S. attorney. But before that, I want to have a little fun. Coming up later in this hour, we are going to talk about whether we should be talking to each other on transit. Lots of shockwaves in the social media world this week after Boston Mayor Michelle Wu said we should. A lot of people didn't like that. So are you a train talker or not?
I'm actually not a train talker.
And why?
I get the instinct. I think it's great to be friendlier, especially in these times, but I'm usually reading a book.
Fair enough. All right. And for listeners, again, later in the show, if you want to call in and tell us whether you're a train talker, 800-423-8255. On a much more serious note, coming up on the one-year anniversary since the January 6th insurrection, ongoing investigations and potential prosecutions. In focus last time we talked with you, you ended up leaving your position not too long after the last time we talked. Much of that work has been out of the D.C. office. But I do want to ask, almost a year later, do you feel that we have adequately handled the aftermath? Have enough folks been held accountable? Is there more you'd like to see?
Yes, I think for the most part, we have properly handled the aftermath. I think in the narrower frame, thinking just about criminal prosecutions of people who breached the Capitol, I don't think the Justice Department under Trump or Biden has gotten enough credit for that. I think you saw the system respond quickly and decisively to hold accountable the people who breached the Capitol. I think the public had faith in the system working there, and I think those cases have been resolved for the most part proportionally. I think the January 6th committee, to the extent it can avoid being egregiously politicized, is a good idea to take a look at what happened, why it happened, and whether others, you know, who is responsible for what happened. So I think overall it's a healthy process.
So, you know, you just say it's important to avoid being egregiously politicized, and it does seem that response to that day continues to be extremely partisan. Do you think that's dangerous for democracy? Do you think we're in a fragile place?
You know, I don't. I actually don't. I see a lot of commentators who think that we are. But, for example, look at the recent highly contentious elections in Virginia and New Jersey, for example. You know, you felt like you were back in 2015, right? And they were, you know, aggressively argued campaigns. There were accusations going back and forth. But at the end of the day, an election happened. It was close in both places. People accepted the results, and life went on. And I think you're going to see that continue. And so while I think what happened on January 6th was appalling, I do not think that it's the harbinger of a trend.
So let's bring our focus closer to home and partisan divides here in the Commonwealth. And what I'm particularly interested in, you served in a Republican administration. Let's start with Charlie Baker, Massachusetts governor. We've heard so many times over the last few years that he's one of, and at different times has been, the most popular governor in the country. Now not seeking reelection, were you and concerns about his ability to survive through a primary in his own party. He himself said this would be a nasty campaign. I've got other business to focus on. Are you surprised he's not running?
I'm not surprised he's not running, but not for those reasons. I'm not surprised he's not running because I can't imagine why you would want a third term in that job. The personal cost of the job is high. You're constantly under scrutiny. Every single thing you or your family says or does is under scrutiny. Your schedule is never your own. I think there are very personal reasons why 8 years of that job would be enough. So it actually didn't surprise me that he didn't run for a third term. I think the concerns about where he is vis-a-vis the party probably just made the decision that much easier for him. But overall, it didn't surprise me that he wouldn't want to be governor for 12 years.
So I want to talk about the state of the party itself here in the Commonwealth. State Party Chair Jim Lyons celebrated the fact that Baker isn't running again. And we should note there have been extensive calls for Lyons' resignation after a number of scandals in the state party, the state party committee. But setting that aside for a second, Lyons and the Republican leadership in Massachusetts are all in on Donald Trump, and so are Republican primary voters. But we know that Baker and prior Republican governors have succeeded in this state really by being more moderate and attracting some independent voters, maybe even more conservative Democratic voters. Is the current state of the Massachusetts Republican Party and the focus of its leadership viable in this state?
The short answer to me, I think, is no. I think that if you want to remain relevant as a Republican in this state, as an elected Republican in this state, I think you have to go with the Charlie Baker recipe. My personal view is you have to be more moderate. You have to attract independents and moderate Democrats. And I think one of the things to really admire about Massachusetts over the past few decades is its willingness to sort of cross party lines, as it were, and elect moderate Republicans to the governorship. This is obviously a very blue state, but I think there's an underlying sense for a lot of people that one-party dominance of the government is not healthy. And so you want a break on the legislature, for example. And so you want a moderate Republican governor. I think that's all very healthy. So I think Republican viability in this state depends on keeping that in mind. I think I understand why the state party thinks there is more support in the state for a more Trumpian approach than people think there is. But I don't think it's a way to stay relevant here. I don't think it's a way to win elections.
So I asked you back in January when we talked last, after you had told reporters you would consider running for office someday, whether you had a specific office in mind. Here was your answer in part.
I have no position or vacancy in mind that I would run for. It just seems to me that in the future, I've enjoyed this kind of public service work. I could see myself back in public service in the executive branch, or I could see myself running for office at some point, but that would be long from now, I think.
I know you know where I'm going. It's a year later. Governor Baker isn't running again. You say we need somebody more moderate. Jeff Deal right now is the Republican running, and he says he's got the backing of Donald Trump. Have you thought about a run for governor?
Well, I think what I'll say is I have been following what's been going on with the party, and I think like many others, I was surprised that Karen Pulido also stepped off, as well as Baker, leaving a big gap on the Republican side. But beyond that, I don't want to comment right now on whether I, you know, whether I am or am not thinking about running for that office.
So let's talk about the last position you held, U.S. Attorney, and partisanship, because I'm sure that you watched the fight over Rachel Rollins's confirmation in the U.S. Senate. That was the first time for a roll call vote since 1975 on a confirmation like that, contentious process. Do you think that that sort of partisan division will make it harder for her in the role, or is that sort of separate politics that doesn't affect the U.S. attorney in the day-to-day job?
It won't make it harder for her in the role. This is, again, a deeply blue state. It makes her a martyr here in the Commonwealth. So I don't think it will impede whatever support she's going to receive. I think that the key for Rachel is that she has become a polarizing figure, in part because of her own actions and her own approach to interacting with the public. And so I think what will be important is that once she steps into the job, I think there needs to be a little bit of breathing room. I mean, the office needs to take a wait-and-see attitude. The public needs to take a wait-and-see attitude. Let her get her sea legs in the job. There's a lot more nuance to Rachel Rollins than sometimes I think what people perceive publicly. And so you have to give her the opportunity to show that in the job, and I think it'll work out.
And what do you think is the most important focus for the U.S. attorney over the next few years in terms of cases to prosecute, areas of emphasis? What would you want to see?
Well, there are a few things percolating that I think the U.S. attorney needs to focus on. One is something that really strikes me is that back in 2017, the opioid epidemic was a tremendous focus. I remember when I applied to be the U.S. attorney, both senators asked me about it. Over 2,000 people a year were dying of opioid overdoses. So that was an issue. You see less press about that today, but you still have fentanyl and meth coming over the border from Mexico in massive quantities. And so I think the U.S. attorney has to focus on that. I haven't heard much from the Justice Department, from the Attorney General about it. But I think she's going to need to pay attention to it, because I think that's an ongoing threat for the Commonwealth. Violent crime is on the rise. I know people like to cite the fact that homicides seem to not be up so much in Boston. But overall, violent crime is rising, and I don't think Massachusetts will be immune to that. Now, from her days as the Suffolk County DA, I think she has a lot of experience dealing with street-level violent crime. I think she should continue now on the federal side to cooperate closely with the locals in that area. A third one that comes to mind, which I think is sometimes difficult for Democrat U.S. attorneys, is public corruption. You know, if you're a Republican U.S. attorney, prosecuting public corruption aggressively in the Commonwealth is easier because you don't have ties to what is usually the Democratic Party, right, involved on the state level. But if you are a Democrat U.S. attorney, you often find yourself prosecuting Democrat Party public officials. And that can sometimes be a little dicey because you may be thinking about a future in state politics or something like that. So I hope that she remains aggressive. The office is traditionally aggressive on public corruption cases, as you've seen over the years. And I hope that she keeps that up in her new role.
All right. And just a last note there. According to both GBH and the Boston Globe, violent crime is down in Boston, bucking national trends. I want to ask you just one last legacy question for you. You may be most known for Varsity Blues, the college admissions scandal.
Sure.
What strikes me about that is, and I don't know, but I'm assuming that that's not when you took the role, you thought, what I want to do is go after college admissions, right? And that's my plan. I think that one came upon you. How much does a U.S. attorney's legacy wind up being what they come across versus what they set out to do at the beginning?
Oh, I think often, meaning often your legacy is forged in the cases that the office happens to be doing. When Preet Bharara became the U.S. attorney in New York, I'm sure he wasn't counting on being the U.S. attorney best known for insider trading prosecutions, for example, if you remember those days. The office was already doing that, and he stepped in as U.S. attorney, ably led the office, and took credit for that initiative, right? And Varsity Blues is similar. I think a key piece of advice for someone like Rachel, and what I mean by that, is a local DA coming in as the U.S. attorney, is don't play small ball. You're not there to do street corner, hand-to-hand drug deal prosecutions or things like that. That's not what the feds do. You should be thinking on a broader scale, a more ambitious scale. And so what you want is to encourage your line prosecutors to take calculated risks in the public interest. If they feel comfortable taking those risks, the result is ambitious impact prosecutions like Varsity Blues or INSYS or the NECC compounding pharmacy case a few years ago. That's what the feds do best. And so you want to support your people who are willing to do those cases for you if you give them the flexibility to do it and they know that they will be supported.
All right. That is Andrew Lelling, former U.S. attorney, now a partner at Jones Day. Appreciate the time. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks a lot.
For many people, it is their worst nightmare. Maybe it's yours. You're on the train or the bus, minding your own business. When?
I beg your pardon. Aren't you Guy Haines? By the way, my name is Bruno. Bruno Anthony.
How do you do?
I don't talk much. You go ahead and read. Now, it must be pretty exciting to be so important.
Tennis player isn't so important.
Oh, but people who do things are important. Me, I never seem to do anything.
A scene there with Farley Granger and Robert Walker from Alfred Hitchcock's Strangers on a Train, 1951. Why are we talking about talking on trains? Because the Twitterverse exploded this week after Boston Mayor Michelle Wu said in an interview with Politico's Lisa Kaczynski, quote, "We've got to change the culture of riding the T. It is a civic space for community conversations, but everyone's always really quiet on there," end quote. And it turns out people have very strong feelings about that idea, and we want to know, do you? Join the conversation. Do you strike up chats on transit? Do you want strangers to talk to you on the T? And what would you do if someone did? Does gender, COVID, or something else influence your feelings about that? Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. We have a couple of great guests to chat about this through the why or why not of talking with strangers on public transit. Kiana Agbai, writer at the blog Harlem Lovebirds, and Joe Kahane, a Boston-born journalist and author of the book, The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Kiana, welcome back.
Thank you.
Joe, welcome back to you, too.
Hey, Tiziana.
Great to have you. So, Kiana, I'm going to turn to you first. How do you feel about chats on the T? Has a conversation, you know, a stranger ever approached you on public transit and struck one up?
I have a long history of riding the T. I came out to Boston all the way back in 1998 from Ohio to go to Wellesley College, and I have so many memories of people talking to me over the years on the train. I now have a 7 and 11-year-old. We haven't been back on the train since before March 2020, but that's one of the things we always love doing as a family. My kids are talkative to each other on the train, but I'm really anticipating getting back on the train next year and am used to people starting conversations.
And you welcome that, it sounds like, Kiana.
It depends on the vibe that they're giving off. You know, the kids, especially with the stranger danger, you know, they're a little wary, but we can usually gauge, you know, the intention of someone's talking to us and we just go from there. But I welcome the opportunity to have neighborly conversations.
So, Joe, talking to people, strangers, it's something you want people to do. You wrote a book about it. I was struck by how much in social media this week this comment from Michelle Wu just stirred up conversation, people feeling very strongly about it one way or the other. Why do you think that is? Why is this such a visceral topic for people?
Yeah, it happens everywhere. I mean, so there have been initiatives in London on the tube, backed by the BBC, to try to get people to talk to each other. And that was met with a great outpouring of rancor. People definitely went kind of berserk. We're phenomenally pessimistic about the prospect of talking to strangers on a train, partly due to the idea of stranger danger, partly perhaps due to a couple bad experiences we might have had. But over the last 15 years, there's been a great deal of research that shows that though we are very pessimistic about the chances of having like an enjoyable interaction on a train, it tends to go pretty well. There have actually been experiments by Nicholas Epley and Juliana Schroeder at the University of Chicago where they had commuters go onto Chicago's mass transit system, onto trains and buses, and chat up strangers. So they would ask them how they anticipated this was going to go in advance, and they thought it was going to be a disaster, a prelude to violence, whatever. And then when they did it, they found it was actually quite easy and quite enjoyable.
And did they say they'd do it again?
That's like the hardest thing with a lot of the people researching this is that again and again and again, we see experiments where they send people out to talk to strangers and people tend to come back with very positive experiences. And then the researchers will say, well, you know, has your life been changed by this? You're going to do it again? And they were like, no, absolutely not. Because there's a social norm against it. The social norm is very powerful against having these sorts of improvisational interactions.
So, Kiana, one of the things that I want to ask you, especially because I'm picturing you, I understand it's been since before the pandemic, but you and your kids on the train. I often think, well, is there a dimension to this that has to do with being captive? You can't get away. You can't get away, right? Until the train stops at the next station or until the bus stops at the next bus stop, you're there, that person's there. Once you start, you're stuck. Talk about that a little bit. And as you prepare your answer, I do want to invite people in again. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Do you feel stuck when somebody tries to talk to you on the train? I'm going to go to the phones in just a second. Kiana, go ahead.
I think there's a level of unease from a stranger speaking to you, but there's also a level of an opportunity. I think, especially having children, if I'm alone, I think I'm more apt to talk versus with the children, because a lot of times I want to be fully present for them. But having their attention span, like right there, having to talk to someone, sometimes you're concerned, are they going to ask for something, you know, especially if someone's asking for money. But I also think there's the option of getting off at the next stop and hopping on a different car. So I always keep that in the back of my mind as an out if I need to.
All right, let's hear from listeners first. Kate from Facebook said, oh, hell no, do not talk to me. If I am on the T, I'm reading my book and not interacting with other humans. I'm either mentally gearing up to go to work or trying to unwind my brain after. None of that involves talking to people. Let's go to the phones too, 800-423-8255. People are calling in like crazy. I cannot see where Alex is from. Alex is calling. Alex, where are you from? Where are you calling from and what's on your mind?
Yeah, hi. I'm calling from Milton, Massachusetts.
Go ahead.
And I want to echo the sentiment of the Facebook post. I mean, when I get on the T to get from point A to point B, you know, I'm either focused on what I'm going to do or unwind from the day. And as a commentator mentioned earlier, if someone approaches you and has a question, in the back of my head, I'm like, okay, this person wants something. What's it going to be? And it's kind of bothersome. And the other thing we got to think about is people's personalities. Some people are inherently introverted and they don't feel necessary.
Thank you. Oh, we just lost Alex. I think Alex had a little more to say there, but we just lost him. So I'm going to come back to you, Joe, and I'm just going to say, what about the stress levels? What do you know from the research about how stressful it is for people to encounter strangers? There are a lot of people who use transit to kind of detox or de-stress from their day or ramp up to get ready for it.
Yeah, so some of the research has found that people expect those conversations to be really tiring. They expect them to be exhausting, right? But what the research has found is that it's actually kind of invigorating to people. You know, it has to go well. It can't just be someone pestering you. It can't be someone being a creep. It can't be someone bothering you. You know, the person has to be engaged. You have to be having an actual conversation. But the research suggests that it's not actually more tiresome. It's not actually less pleasant for a commuter, even when they're kind of tired, to have these sorts of interactions.
So, Kiana, I noticed that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu really wanted to focus on community conversation. I am curious about that. We've had you on a number of times for these community conversations, right, where we take a topic, we talk with listeners, we all think about it together. Do you think that it is a public space ripe for making progress together as community? I had never thought of it that way myself before.
That was a new concept for me, reading the interview. And I think, you know, finding ways to reconnect as we come into the new year and even thinking about my children being able to get back on the train, I think having that option, I think it's positive, you know, to think of that. Can we have discourse, especially if you're on something like a commuter rail, like where I live, and you have perhaps a longer ride and you start to see people you know, like sometimes I remember my kids would see neighbors, our friends from school on the train, and so they'll want to chat with them. So perhaps there's an opportunity to engage in conversation in that way if you're on like a commuter rail and have the opportunity for community discussions there.
All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-423-8255. Megan from Plymouth. Go ahead, Megan.
Hi. I was just wondering in that research if there was any differentiation between like a male and female response. I know if I'm on the T, if a male approaches me, I might be a little bit more hesitant thinking, okay, what's the intention here? And I also might be more hesitant to strike up a conversation with the male, with them maybe misinterpreting my intent. I mean, I know most people are friendly and don't take it that way, but a lot of people, unfortunately, we run into those conversations all the time as women.
Thank you. Thank you, Megan. And Joe, I'm going to turn to you on this in a second, but I'm going to add another voice, Tiffany from Facebook. My daughter rides the T often and always has to deal with creepy guys hitting on her. She just wants to listen to her music and get to her destination safely. I'm turning to you, especially Joe, because I remember when we talked about your book, we had women call in and say, this is different for women. Talking with strangers is different. So let me give you a chance to weigh in here.
Yeah, for sure. It absolutely is. And when I was doing this book, I was really careful not to generalize from my experience as a 6 foot tall white guy. It's definitely going to be much more complicated for people of color, for women, for sure. In the studies that have been done, the participants have been mostly women, for one thing. So the people who are having good experiences, they are majority women in these studies. But I totally understand and I totally sympathize. And it seems like a nightmare, the harassment that women do have to deal with, particularly young women. So, you know, you'd have to do what you feel comfortable with. And in many cases, and I made a point of talking to a lot of women who talk to strangers on the subway in the street. And it's about feeling comfortable. It's about making sure that there are other people around. It's about maybe only doing it when you're with someone else, when you're with a friend. It could be just talking to other women, so you're not engaging with men at all to eliminate the possibility that your interest might be misinterpreted. There are ways around it, but for sure, it's much more complicated for women than it would be for me.
Kiana, any thoughts you want to add there?
Yeah, I definitely agree. And that's kind of the angle I was taking with my kids, too, if I'm alone or with the kids. Either way, I think you have to have a barometer and kind of gauge the situation, and definitely keeping safety a priority.
Let's go back to the phones, 800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll start with Tara in Roslindale. Go ahead.
Hi, great conversation. Just wanted to share that we actually miss commuting. My husband would take my 5-year-old before the pandemic on the train, and we actually built a really wonderful community of who we call train friends. We would off the train get together for pizza parties, and the conductors would also show up. So we miss that. We have a pandemic baby who, similar to Kiana's family, we have not been back on the train, but look forward to when we can soon.
That is an incredible story. That's just really something. I do want to ask you, too, when you get back on, do you think the presence of masks will change that at all? Will it make it harder for your kids, for example, to engage with people, or for you? Do you think it'll hold you back at all?
I don't think so. I think just the social connection, really seeing you know, the joy when we have had an opportunity to see our train friends out and about with masks on. From the look in their eyes, that there is just a warmth and an excitement to see each other and connect. So our kids have been going to school wearing their masks with their teachers, and
you don't think it'll hold them back? That's so great. Thank you. And also Karen on our team here reminding me, Joe Biden actually used to talk about having train friends on the Amtrak commuter D.C. to Wilmington, Delaware. This train friends idea is a fun one. I'm going to pick up one more call here. Deb in Newton. Deb, go ahead.
Hi, I'm one of the people who loves train conversations. And I feel that it just gives a feeling that the community, the city is safe and we're all friends. I had a experience I wanted to mention, which was a friend and I would do Halloween activities where we would dress up in costume. And one year we were waitresses and we brought ourselves menus and aprons and matching outfits on the T, and we offered people to would take their orders and then bring the food for them from another train further back. A third of the people thought we were nuts. A third of the people went along with us. They loved it that we made their day, and a third of the people just ignored us.
Well, and I have to ask you, where did you get the food, Deb?
There was no food. We just made it up.
It was just a pretend. That's great. Thanks for the story, Deb.
We pretended that there was a food car.
I appreciate it. Thanks. And so, Joe, I want to turn back to you. So Deb and her friend basically used a prop, right, a gimmick, a way to break the ice with strangers on the T and have a conversation with mixed results. Some loved it, some didn't. But for those who are listening to this conversation and think maybe I'd like to start up some chatting when I'm on the bus or I'm on the train, from your research, what's a way for people to do that?
Yeah, there's a great one that deals with the biggest problem, the biggest impediment for people talking to others on mass transit, which is the social norm against it, right? The fact that people don't seem to do it. And the way to do it is to hit that head on. It's a technique called pre-framing that I learned from a woman named Georgie Nightingale, who's a communications expert in London, where you acknowledge what you're doing. And what that does is it alleviates people's fear that you're unhinged in some way, right? Because when people violate social norms, we tend to think that something's wrong. They want something, they might have some kind of issue. And what Georgie recommended was you notice something that you want to comment on and you want to ask about, and you lead by saying, look, I know we're not supposed to talk to people on the Green Line, but I just have to say, like, I like your glasses or whatever it is, whatever thing you're interested in. And that just dials down the wariness a little bit, and it opens the way for a conversation to happen, because that wariness is like the hardest hurdle to get over before you can actually have a conversation with someone.
So you,
but I did that a lot and it worked phenomenally well. It's like a magic trick.
You name it, that you know you're doing something that violates the norm or the expected behavior.
Yeah, it shows you have willpower, you're self-aware, all the things that people tend to assume you might not, the capabilities you might not possess when you start initiating these sorts of interactions, for sure. But yeah, it just smooths things over. It makes it so much easier.
800-423-8255. Steven's on the line in Brockton. Steven, go ahead.
Hi, I'm finding this conversation fascinating. I'm not from here. I've been living here for 20 years. I'm Irish, and as many Irish people, I love the art of conversation, and I think an awful lot of the points being made are really, while valid, are also, you know, you're going to end up with the depends at the end of it, like they say, you know, a young girl on a train on her own with headphones in, there's just no point in trying to engage in a conversation. She's showing a sign she's not interested in talking. But and the last point actually made by the writer, whose book I'd love to read, is it is really important. Some of the things that he just mentioned, I actually do myself an awful lot of the time, which is acknowledge, because people need to be sort of disarmed, because like you said, it isn't the social norm, at least not here. People where I come from would chat in public a hell of a lot more than they do here. But the whole thing is really fascinating. I personally would always like to try to have the conversation rather than not.
Stephen, thanks for the call. I'm going to pick up one more here. Danny in Medford. Danny, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. I just wanted to point out just how it affects dating and finding your partner today. I mean, I have girlfriends who met their husbands on a train. Or they're now husbands on a train. And, you know, I think that even before COVID, just with people wearing their earbuds and, you know, really tuning themselves out, people are now relegated to online dating because people don't want to chat in public anymore, because it isn't a societal norm. And, you know, because they think that you are crazy if you go up to somebody in a coffee shop or on the T or on a bus. And so, you know, I think it would just be interesting to chat about how that affects, you know, finding partners today.
Great call, Danny. Kiana, let's chat about it. Are we missing important human connection?
I think so. I think even just this 20 months or however long it's been of not being on the train, my kids have expressed how much they've missed it. I mean, it's been a connection for us to do things like to go to South Station, hop over to the Children's Museum, and, you know, what happens when we start to see people that we know, or you get into a routine. We've missed that as a family. And I think that's one of the reasons why we're excited to pick back up watching, writing The Train next year, so that we can feel like we're part of a community again.
And Joe, this specific dimension that Danny is talking about, love relationships, finding signals to send to each other that we might be in each other's futures. Can we do that talking to strangers these days?
Yeah, I mean, it's about building a social network. It's about meeting people. So whether it's a romantic partner or just a new friend or an acquaintance, or you're just having a pleasant chat on the train, there are tremendous benefits to this. And, you know, and to the point of like what this means for society, the research is showing that when people have even passing conversations with strangers, it can reduce loneliness. It can foster a sense of connectedness to the place where they live. It can reduce prejudice. It can enhance trust. Like, there are all these really positive things for society that can occur when enough people do this. But at a time of epidemic loneliness, anything that's going to help you meet more people is going to be to the benefit of you and the benefit of society.
All right, we're going to grab one more call. Jane is in Northeastern Massachusetts. Jane, briefly, go ahead.
Sure. I take the commuter rail from Providence, and I had a wonderful experience just the other day. I was getting off at Back Bay, and this young girl saw my ring, and she goes, "Oh, your ring is beautiful." And another woman turned around and said, "Oh, turquoise, that's from my country. I live in Greece." We all smiled, got off the train. I was like, "Oh, normalcy, pleasantries. People are becoming more normal." I had a great experience. So I always smile and say hello to people. And sometimes they look at me and go, "Oh, wacko." Sometimes they look at me and smile back. So that's what I just wanted to share. I think it's a great idea.
I love that you called, Jane. Thanks so much, and thanks for sharing that story with us. Okay, we're just about out of time, but Joe, I heard you chuckle. So quick last word from you.
Yeah, I would just encourage people to do it. There are a lot of power. There's a lot of benefits to it. It's tremendously beneficial to individuals and to society at large. It's easier than you think, and other people might be much more receptive than you would imagine them to be.
And Kiana, we have time for a last word from you, too. Last thought.
We can't wait to get on the train in the new year. So you might see us around next year.
Let us know when you do. That's Kiana Agbai, writer at the blog Harlem Lovebirds, and Joe Cohane, a Boston-born journalist and author of the book The Power of Strangers, The Benefits of Connecting in a Suspicious World. Kiana, thanks.
Thank you.
Joe, thanks for coming back. Good to have you again.
My pleasure.
And that's our show for today. Radio Boston's produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal's our technical director. Karen Schiffman, our interim executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Great talking to you today. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.